Hello and welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about dopamine. It's pretty trendy right now to talk about things like optimizing dopamine levels or doing a so-called dopamine detox or fast. In this episode, Reed and I debunk some of the common misconceptions about dopamine, challenge the idea of a dopamine detox, explore the role of dopamine in motivation, habit formation, addiction, and psychological well-being, discuss ways to cultivate and maintain healthy dopaminergic function, explore the ways that psychedelics affect dopamine, and much, much more. A few announcements for you before we get into the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, you can check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've heard Reed and I talk a bit about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support our show, the best way to do that is to leave us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, you can like the video, subscribe to the channel, maybe even leave a comment below. Without further ado, here's our discussion on dopamine. Reed, we're at it again. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for asking. It's a beautiful day outside. I enjoy this podcast time we have.
Indeed.
Our sacred hour to chat about something.
Something that we're interested in. Hopefully some of the people listening are also interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Today we decided to meander into the neurochemical soup of the brain and other parts of the body and talk specifically about dopamine.
Dopamine's having its day on the internet, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we hear things like dopamine reset, dopamine detox, dopamine fast. Usually it comes out of the mouths of sort of the productivity gurus or the, what's the term? Optimization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the optimization folks.
And I'll say from my end, it represents both oh, cool. I'm glad we're looking at this stuff and it's part of the conversation, like stigma reducing, more interest in like applied neuroscience, the mind, mental health. And also it brings up a lot of cringing because of the misinformation and inaccuracies out there. So I'm just holding both of those.
Yeah. Which I think is important because it's not uncommon for folks to hear about a little bit of a little science and then extrapolate that science probably beyond the bounds that it should be extrapolated and overgeneralize and oversimplify. Mm-hmm. We were talking before we hit record that, you know, human beings, although we are comprised of complicated machinery, we are more than the sum of our neurochemical parts. At least I like to think so.
Yeah.
Perhaps the materialist reductionists out there would disagree, but that's my sense of being a being, of being a human on the planet.
Yeah, you're a neurotransmitter soup and a whole lot more.
Yeah, just an electrified, wet meat balloon supercomputer.
There's a quote I like about how often we're wrong as humans that I'll share if you'll allow it.
I'll allow
By H.L. Mencken. Explanations exist. They have existed for all time. There is always a well-known solution to every human problem. Neat, plausible, and wrong.
Neat, plausible, and wrong. I agree. It seems like in my own life, whenever I feel like I've got it all figured out, it's not too long before that is no longer true. And I don't have it all figured out.
Yeah, it's kind of a paradox. Like again, maybe I'm just full of paradox right now, but you know, there's beauty and simplicity in boiling it down. And there's also the fact that, you know, we don't understand it all. We don't have the answers. And, we usually only have a piece of the puzzle and we're doing the best we can along the way.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So what is dopamine, Reed?
Ooh, dopamine is pretty cool because it's one of the neurotransmitters I like to geek out on in particular because it propagates the survival of our species. I like to first look at, where does something come from? Why did it evolve? And I think evolution stumbled on dopamine as a way of helping us find things that would lead to our survival, like food, procuring food, and like reproducing, mm-hmm. the propagation of our species. And this was, so that's one thing I like to remember, is how might that system look that evolved in a time when we were, you know,
worms,
cavemen, yeah. or
all the way back to the nematodes. Yeah.
Or living in nature. How would that system look if we drop it into our tech crazed society right now? Mm-hmm. And what pitfalls might there be?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been, so my comment about worms, I'm listening to this book, The History of Intelligence.
Me too. You tipped me off, and yeah. I like it.
Yeah. It's incredibly complex. Like, I'm not a neuroscientist, but it's, the way he tells the story is pretty cool. I'm just partway through it now, but yeah, he starts out by, you know, our the ancestors that we share with like fish and other vertebrates, were these little worms. Was it nematodes? I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Sort of, invertebrates that eventually, you know, developed spines and nervous systems. But early on in our evolution, it was the sort of presence of dopamine that sort of had us, as you stated, going toward things that would help us survive and propagate the species and away from things that wouldn't.
Yeah. So while you hear dopamine oversimplified on the internet and in the news, there's an academic quote that I think shines a light on some of the complexities by a faculty member at Vanderbilt, Aaron Calipari, who said, "In the press, dopamine is often referred to as a pleasure molecule or a reward molecule. Dopamine is not a reward molecule at all," she says. "It instead helps encode information about all types of important and relevant events and drive adaptive behavior, regardless of whether or not it is positive or negative."
Mm. Yeah. So it's not, people talk about getting dopamine hits as if it, to imply that the dopamine is sort of just the pleasure particle or the reward neurotransmitter. But it sounds like it's much more complex than that. And dopamine is also implicated in things like movement, cognition, memory, not just in reward and punishment.
Yeah. And we have a baseline level of dopamine at rest. And there are these peaks and troughs, if you will, spikes in it, that I think is where the concept of hit comes from. Mm. And so you can see where that could be a useful way to think about it, depending on, you know, your framework, if it's semi-accurate and applies to you. So there's that. And you also have peripheral dopamine. Like, we have dopamine in our heart, our vessels, our kidneys, our retinas. And there are multiple pathways. Like you mentioned, the Parkinsonian one, the nigrostriatal dopamine pathway, that damage to dopamine containing neurons in this area is what leads to Parkinson's disease. Whether it's like a classic Parkinson's or even a drug induced, like excess super high doses of a really bad stimulant or meth derivative, for example. And so there's all that as a backdrop to say I think it is useful to talk about dopamine as the molecule of more, or to talk about its pleasure and reward, because that is a part of it. Like, there is a, what's called the, another pathway that dopamine is really a key neurotransmitter in, and that is perhaps more relevant than the movement one to our discussion today, the mesolimbic pathway, which is, you know, where we do get those reward spikes that reinforce our behaviors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned the molecule of more, which also happens to be a book title of one of, I think, two of the more popular books about dopamine. The other one being Dopamine Nation, I think.
Yeah,
by Anna Lemke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, she's at Stanford.
Okay.
So those are good. And I think that's what, you know, that's one step along the way. Like, books aren't written like peer-reviewed papers are. Like, right. You can be an academic person and say whatever you want, like that quote I read. It's them saying whatever they want. I'm choosing to bring it on here because it represents, a useful side of the coin of the discussion. But you can also write a book on whatever you want and cite small studies or big, really you know, well grounded ones that you can drive more conclusions from. But the fact of the matter is we're left with this evidence to make sense of. We don't understand the whole picture. And people, there are dopamine related struggles that everyone experiences that I think it makes it worthwhile to deconstruct the dopamine system and try and shine a light of awareness on it.
Right. Yeah. I like the way you said that, dopamine related. So not that we could boil everything down, like let's say with addiction, to simply an issue of dopamine desensitization and then the efforts for dopamine resensitization. It's not the entire story, but it is dopamine related. So we can make maybe assumptions and they could be proven wrong through future studies. And I think Dr. Lemke does that quite a bit in her book. A lot of case examples, which is good reading, but it's an N of one. That she's applying sort of the general science to.
Yeah. And those are what really helps someone take the leap from like bench to bedside, we call in healthcare, or translational step from how to use it in your life, even if we don't have the whole picture. But I think while we're on this big picture view, it might help to just lay another foundation of the role of neurotransmitters in our patterns, behaviors. Like our brain is always in this tension between kind of seeking reward and avoiding harm. Like a lot of our circuits, if we were to oversimplify, are wired that way. So the brain is wired to move away from harm towards the good, more positive feelings. And there are chemicals to guide that. And this all happens in a very rapid way. Like each chemical neurotransmitter has a job to do, and then it turns off when the job is done. Like dopamine, if we are to call it that molecule of more, or the kind of motivation from a big spike of reward, there is a need and you can meet it quickly with dopamine. And then when that spike is over, and it depends on the source of dopamine, like if it's a hit of cocaine, then it's a quick spike, quick on, quick off, and a crash, and a more likely to seek and a more addictive potential there. If it's a cold plunge, that might raise it also like double your tonic dopamine level, then maybe that's a little more lasting, a little more sustainable, less, you know, it's harder to get addicted to cold plunging, right? But the same pathways are at play. Then you have serotonin, just to put it in perspective, you get this like feeling of social place, importance. It might be from like being seen or respected, or like pride, and talking mostly positive side of pride. And it's interestingly easier to kind of see and act on this in others, but hard to see looking in at ourselves in some ways. But we talk about oxytocin on here, of course, with MDMA. And it's another good example, because oxytocin can lead to milk letdown as one kind of central meets peripheral application of it, but also the comfort of social trust and safety, like in MDMA therapy. And then, you know, a whole other soup of endorphins that kind of increase pleasure, reduce pain, make us, that kind of emerged for, getting that food and procuring that species and reducing pain in order to do these steps for a time. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good tour of sort of the neurotransmitters that I guess you could say are the chemical substrate of what it feels like to be a person. And like we were talking about before, everything that Reed just said is I guess maybe an oversimplification,
yeah,
but it's
big time.
It's also not inaccurate, right? And I've heard people say of oxytocin that yes, it's sort of the hug everybody, nurse your baby, feel supported by your community neurotransmitter, but it's also perhaps implicated in our sort of in-group, out-group, quote unquote, tribal nature, where we feel bonded to the in-group, but also fearful of the out-group. I heard Jamie Wheel actually one time say it's the love your neighbor, but it's also the curb stomp your enemy neurotransmitter, which I thought was a poetic and bold way of describing it.
And that's a great example. And there would be some serotonin in the mix there as well, among others. Like in this soup, there is not one neurotransmitter doing anything in isolation, it's always part of this system. But and our brain is always looking for you're on the lookout for those more positive feeling things. But there, it's important to remember they're short spurts, and they evolve that way to be released in these spikes above baseline, then return to baseline or whatever a new baseline is. We could talk about that. But when the problem is, practically speaking, when they wear off and we feel an absence of that good stuff that was just there, there's a potential, there's a risk there of us getting caught up in that, that, oh no, I don't feel as good as I did. And a risk of us seeking the good feeling where, you know, just as a foundational concept, I think it's helpful to know that there are frustrating trade-offs or frustrating feelings as a trade-off with all these neurotransmitters. Like when you step towards new and exciting things, more dopamine, you often move away from the social bonds of safety at the same time. Or when you step towards like being seen in social ways of that like serotonin that we're talking about, you may get some rewards with, you know, positive feelings from that, but you may also have some of the other cortisol stress related changes as well, like stress hormones, which are worth mentioning, like cortisol. When it turns on, it's there to like stop you, to stop what you're doing or give you a warning signal, to alert you to potential threats, like have our stress systems on board. And at least gives you that time period where, you know, you're ready to pounce if needed, and it might be on at a time you don't need it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cortisol is another one of those neurochemicals or whatever, that has been oversimplified and even kind of demonized, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, cortisol is the stress hormone. We need to reduce cortisol. Well, no, like elevations in cortisol is what helps you wake up in the morning and get ready for the day. So it's not so simple as like, okay, we need to maximize dopamine. We need to minimize cortisol. We need to maximize serotonin or, you know, yeah. So again, just another probably now at this point obnoxious comment about not oversimplifying.
So yeah, let's break down dopamine a bit then. With another disclaimer I like to make is that dopamine is involved in reward and pleasure, like we've been talking about, or hedonics, you might call it. Mm-hmm. But hedonics and the higher order motivation to do something are different circuits. Like the way we experience pleasure is one thing, but what about the motivation to do something as kind of tedious, perhaps, as doing the dishes or updating your LinkedIn profile?
Right.
Like, why do humans do that if only driven by the propagation of species and dopamine?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I've also heard it said that people who maybe have some dysregulation of dopamine circuits, it's a lot harder for them to do the dishes or to update their LinkedIn profile than it might be somebody who's more neurotypical.
I think that's what many people are experiencing when they turn to something like this dopamine detox concept that, you know, we'll deconstruct a bit. Or I think it stems from a couple other places as well, like the addicted brain, because in patterns of addiction, especially with certain substances and behaviors, you can really alter your experience of dopamine day to day from other sources. There could be a shift towards seeking. Well, let's break down the pathways because I think it helps. A shift towards this mesolimbic pathway, one of the dopamine related pathways that is more hedonic, and away from the mesocortical pathway that is more of that higher order motivation in line with your hopes and dreams and values. And it is, I think we can all relate, sometimes in our life or with some humans, it's so much harder to do the things with the longer term gains, the less pleasurable rewards. And that's even a factor of ADHD. So those, all that being said, there's one other place the dopamine dysregulation comes from, and it's There's a syndrome called dopamine dysregulation syndrome that actually comes from Parkinson's treatment, where if you're using dopamine treatments that are different than like Adderall, dopamine treatments for ADHD, you're using like L-DOPA, whatever, in a small subset, more males and more young, there's a risk of people overusing their dopamine treatments and getting into this hedonic reward-seeking cycle at the expense of almost everything else. Like they're seeking pleasure, taking more of your medicine, seeking pleasure in impulsive, reckless, reward-seeking ways. And I've seen that as well, like a form of that in a subset, a small subset of people taking ADHD meds.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's, you were talking about sort of the balance, the homeostasis that the brain tries to return to as it strikes a balance between these neurochemicals, dopamine included, that's one of the potential drawbacks of being highly dopaminergic is that you might have trouble with impulse control. You might, the risks might be less salient to your conscious mind than they would be if you were, you know, more balanced.
Mm-hmm. There are some meds in that class I'm talking about that have a specific warning label on them around like increases in gambling addiction behavior seen on a medicine. Like you can really alter the circuitry and the primal motivations there, as well as your checks and balances. There's one other interesting thing, part of this syndrome called punding. That's a medical term, but it means like excessively collecting and hoarding and arranging objects.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So is dopamine, that just made me think of OCD. Is dopamine implicated in obsessive compulsive disorder?
And the nice thing about, for any, about our disclaimers at the beginning that everything's interrelated and complicated, right, is that we can just say yes to all that.
Yeah, probably.
but there definitely are, I mean, dopamine is involved in our movements and our mental activities around seeking behaviors and repeating patterns. So it's definitely there, but it's also there in a big way in psychosis and schizophrenia, both primary psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, for example, or drug induced psychosis. You know, if you take too much of a stimulant, like an amphetamine, for example, meth, and I've seen this in people presenting to the hospital ER, you know, you can definitely get into hypomanic, manic, or even psychotic states. And in schizophrenia, there's a lot of the treatments are dopamine blocking antipsychotics. Mm.
And is that in part to help spare them from certainly the sort of oversaturation of dopamine, but also the deep trough you were talking about with addiction or something like cocaine?
No, they have kind of some of them are complicated, mixed antagonist agonist, some of the newer antipsychotics, but classically it's really your, like, the, to oversimplify it would be, you have kind of abnormal dopamine receptors and activities in schizophrenia, and one of the like key parts of the mechanism, the best we understand it, is like a dopamine blocking effect. Mm-hmm. And if you were to give someone who's tripping on a classic psychedelic, say LSD, an antipsychotic, there's a good chance that would have some like psychedelic psychosis reducing activity. You know, I've seen it.
A trip stopper, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, if you taking that same LSD example, in addition to the 5-HT2A, there are dopamine circuits involved. There is dopamine activity going on with a lot of these medicines. You know, even if not the primary one, there, it's worth mentioning these meds aren't so simple of one neurotransmitter impacted.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So do you have more to say on that? Cause I'm now been distracted by my comment about the dopamine trough, and I'm really, you mentioned we could break down like, oversensitization, desensitization stuff.
Because I think those are what get out of whack in someone, who maybe needs a dopamine reset. And, and I guess to paint the picture for that, do you need a dopamine reset, or what someone might call a detox? And I won't call it a detox, because you can't physiologically detox yourself from dopamine. If you did, oh, that would be disastrous, even if it were humanly possible.
Right.
But I do really like the idea of resetting with awareness and some intention your relationship to dopamine and your patterns around that balance between seeking immediate like dopamine spikes or rewards versus your higher values.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know a lot more about the neuroscience than I do as a psychiatrist. So I'll tell you about how I sort of look at this from my psychology lens, and you can tell me if I'm off, because it seems like, you know, we live in a society now where novelty seeking is heavily rewarded, and there's a lot on the menu for us.
TikTok has the menu.
I mean, instant access to anything that would eliminate boredom, right? And spares us from having to just sort of be ourselves and sit with ourselves. And so is it that we are becoming desensitized through this constant, what people will call the dopamine drip or whatever, but, and that's why we need a reset. That's why we need a resensitization, and that this prevalence of dopaminergic stimuli can even lead to things like anhedonia, where you've got college students who just, they have no motivation to do anything, but their eyes are never off of a screen. They're always listening to a podcast, always listening to music, always flipping, scrolling through media. They're looking at a lot of porn, or they're even using substances. But are we sort of bereft of our natural homeostatic set points because of this overstimulation in our environment?
Yeah, it's a riskier environment for everyone. And then there's a risk. The risk, I think, involves throwing off the balance of these pathways. I like to think of it with the analogy of the two wolves, like from kind of indigenous folklore of the wolf you feed. Mm-hmm. I think Carl Jung even used that example, but many people have of, in this case, the wolf you feed, the one that gets stronger, is that hedonic pathway, that mesolimbic, at the expense of your mesocortical pathways, because neurons and pathways that fire together, wire together. Neuroplasticity is happening for better or for worse, right? And like that initial academic quote said, we can reinforce maladaptive behaviors. Right. Humans know how to do that quite well because of how we're wired. But if you take it at the expense of that mesocortical pathway with your executive functioning, your ability to plan out over time, your and part of what Adderall does, it also hits the other one and feels good. But the thing that lets you take actions without the immediate rewards of a big dopamine hit, like updating your LinkedIn profile or whatever, I think it's about this balance, and that's skewing or swinging the pendulum way more over to the hedonic side. And I liken it to having treated a lot of people for ADHD with stimulants, a lot of people successfully, even in people taking it as prescribed, if you're taking it consistently over a long term, there is a form of not that formal dopamine dysregulation syndrome, but on the spectrum of that somewhere, of you've just had your dopamine delivered to you on a silver platter in the form of a morning dose of Adderall, Vyvanse, Ritalin, whatever. And then if that suddenly goes away, it's going to feel different for several days, sometimes more for people. And we're all in tune to a different degree with that inner experience, like we talk about it in many ways on here. And so that, I think, is a dopamine funk that that can result. And if you're seeking out a behavior over and over, like cocaine spike that double triples your dopamine levels acutely, and then call it a crash, if you will, rapid spike, relatively rapid return, or food also can double plus your dopamine level, sex and therefore pornography, like orgasm, things like that, and what happens to your dopamine after that can lead to these repetitive behaviors. And if you repeat them too much, you're your new set point will start to go down, and there can be an anhedonia type picture, different set point, but it can be restored as well.
Right. And that's what we're getting at here, is that, you know, back to our conversation about how we evolved, how our nervous systems evolved. My guess is, and other people smarter than me and have researched this thoroughly will say similar things, is that our nervous system evolved for an environment that changed really, really rapidly in the last couple hundred years. And so, whereas this delicate balance, this dance between those two pathways you were talking about, might have been more easy to maintain when we were hunter-gatherers or something like that. It's become, like, one of our strengths has become a weakness with this, like we described, environment in which we can really just hammer one of those two pathways pretty relentlessly. And I've experienced this myself as I was prepping for this episode, just sort of reflecting on the times of my life when I just felt blah. And sometimes it was, and maybe this might be a chicken and egg issue, but as I look back on it, it was because, I was just hammering those, oversimplification incoming, hammering those dopamine receptors over and over again with just convenient stimuli.
Yeah.
And it took a while. It took a while to sort of reset, to resensitize. In stillness, you know, just touch grass, look at the mountains, that kind of stuff.
When I grew up, you couldn't video game 24/7 even if you wanted to, because the games were more few and far between, and you could beat them and they'd be over, for example. Right. Or when I grew up, there wasn't, I didn't have the internet in high school. Mm-hmm. There was not internet pornography. Like if someone were viewing that, it would be because they've got their hands on a VHS tape or a magazine, for example.
Yeah.
Right. There was a very different access. And now today, have you heard of that, Rabbit smart AI companion device?
No.
It's a little like cool little retro black red box by the people at Teenage Engineering who make those cool instruments where I have their, one of their synthesizers, but you can buy this for, I think $200, 200 something. And it lets you just order a pizza by asking it to order you a pizza, and then it'll show up at your door in half an hour. It'll plug into DoorDash, Uber Eats, whatever it's doing. But we're in an era where the propagation of our species activities, like food and sex, are just at everyone's fingertips in a very risky way.
Yeah. Yeah, the novelty too is something I think about, especially with respect to like pornography and sex. Like you were saying before, you know, you might just have a few sexual partners or a few people who could be sexual partners. Maybe you stumble across a magazine that somebody buried in the woods, or there was that sort of that one folder that everybody went to. Oh, dude, there's a Playboy in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. But now, like you said, at your fingertips is infinite, practically infinite novelty, and we're not even talking about like the AI stuff that's on the horizon. I think, you know, that's not the topic of this episode, but I think, you know, AI pornography, AI girlfriends, boyfriends, this is just going to wreak havoc on these dopamine systems. Yeah.
And it is. You can look around and look at people's relationships to their smartphones and see it and ask them about their, how they feel about their phone viewing or social media viewing patterns. And you also see it even more. They'll share it, but,
or ask them not to, like, you know, ask your typical 20 something, turn your phone off today and navigate the world. And be like, what are you even talking about?
And how does it feel? Like, I love to do that experiment, because it's fascinating. Like, leave my phone behind sometime, like once in a while, and go to the store or even just how does it feel when it's two floors away in the house, and how much phantom phone pain do I have?
I like that phantom phone pain.
I don't know if it's a thing, but I've experienced it.
Trademark Reed Robinson. Yeah, just don't take it into the bathroom. You know, sit on the toilet without looking at your phone.
Mindful toileting. there's one neuroscience concept that I think is useful in talking about this balance. And that's something that is part of the mesolimbic pathway. It's called incentive salience, or you could call it wanting. It's like the motivational value of a learned stimulus. So there's the value of a stimulus in terms of its reward or punishment, right? And then when you combine that with the sometimes added value of what you've learned and associated with that stimulus, then you have this incentive salience, or you have this pattern, this super reward, this potential for skewing things out of balance. And there's also the opposite of that, like aversive salience, or some would call it fearful. But I think that wanting is part of what's driving this skew away from our mesocortical pathways and executive function to organize ourselves over time in good ways.
Yeah. I'm thinking of like the therapy parallels where some of my clients will talk about being very dissatisfied with life, but also they have the awareness that they have everything they need and that their lives are even pretty good.
Yeah.
And you could make the argument that the problem isn't with what's absent in their life. It's the problem is them wanting.
Yeah. Right.
And there's sort of the almost jokingly said advice, like, if you want to be happy, want less.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really, I think, great example of ways we might apply these neurotransmitters to common mood states and things we experience in day-to-day life. Because like with norepinephrine, getting back to some of the other neurotransmitters just for a sec, norepinephrine, you've got like on the flip downside of that, exhaustion, lethargy, or dopamine, the anhedonia, like you mentioned, or serotonin, you might have this grief, guilt, some shame on the other side of that. In addition to using these to your advantage, you also want to understand how they're out of whack or what key features might be there in your really difficult situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But another kind of pathway involved might be worth mentioning for a second is, and then I'll stop throwing pathways in the conversation. I promise, I hope. Anterior cingulate cortex, the ACC, involved in effort computation is why I want to bring it up, because, you know, when you alter the dopamine system in the mesolimbic pathway, messes up your mesocortical pathway and your effort calculation. Like this is also a dopamine rich pathway. So you might end up in a place where you're just seeking low effort. You're only able to do low effort things, whether it's even tiny rewards. And maybe you're just below the surface of where you used to be, feel, and you're just seeking these things to try and get up towards that and just falling back down and down. And that might be an experience some people can relate to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the comment about effort makes me think of ways people can resensitize, right? If they feel like they're in one of these cycles or they're down in this dopamine trough. We've talked a lot about getting comfortable being uncomfortable on the podcast before. And Lemke talks a bit about this in her book.
Mm-hmm.
She's received some criticisms, which I think are interesting, but I won't go into. But I think the principle is sound, that one of the ways maybe to recalibrate the effort seeking that you describe is to just practice being uncomfortable. I'm talking about a specific kind of discomfort, right?
Seek discomfort.
Well, a lot of us have discomfort foisted upon us by our environment, by society, by systems, by oppression. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if you find yourself like the situation you described, where you're sort of dopamine deprived or whatever, and all you can muster are sort of these low effort things to get a little dopamine fix, then it might be time for a holiday. And in that holiday, you might have to sit with discomfort, the discomfort of boredom, the discomfort of surfing the urge to eat that thing or try that drug or look at that thing on the internet. And it's going to suck at first, but if you can use all the good mindfulness strategies that you've learned or could learn to ride the wave, then it'll pay off. And then you might feel in your bones and in your nervous system the energy return to do things that require higher effort. And there's a promise on the other end of that, that usually higher effort endeavors return a greater reward.
Yeah, I love that concept thrown in the mix here. And to be honest, in reflecting on why I do certain things in a day, it's interesting. I was thinking about this morning as I'm on my way to yoga class, knowing we're going to chat about dopamine. I was just thinking, why was it so easy for me to get in my car and start driving there to this place where I'm going to roll out a mat and sweat my ass off and do uncomfortable things? And it has to do with that incentive salience, like what I've associated with the reward. Like, sure, I'll get a spike of dopamine, but I would also get a spike of dopamine from running on the treadmill or sitting on my Peloton exercise bike I have in the basement. There's a good example because I've wanted many times to pick that up as a habit, like saying, oh, wouldn't that be good for my heart in the long term or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the effort computation and the incentive salience and the balance of these three dopamine pathways we've talked about, the mesolimbic, mesocortical, the ACC, if you will, it hasn't really highlighted that as an activity that I've done enough to stick at this stage. And so that's one thing. And then there's also, well, I'll just pause there so I don't run on. I have dopamine fueled rambling at the moment.
Reads on a dopamine tear. No, and what you just described is sort of the biological underpinnings of habit formation, right? And I imagine the first time you went to your yoga class, it wasn't as smooth and as easy, right? The salience wasn't the same. And as you were talking about that, I was thinking about the things that I do that started out really effortful, but now the effort is almost the reward in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going to the gym I'm lifting weights, when I first sort of got back on the horse doing that, I had to drag myself to the gym or I had to pair a different reward. Okay. After the gym, I'm going to have that yummy food that I usually deny myself
or a buddy system, whatever hack you need to do to start.
Yeah. But now it's like, I love it and I know it's going to hurt. And again, the pain, because I've paired it with progress, feeling stronger, changing my physique, it's almost desirable because I know it's signaling something that I want.
And you know what's another interesting example? This one's more complicated, and you can let me know what you think. But I also have a, you've seen it, a nice cold plunge tub on my balcony at home outside a home gym, and I get in that most days. And what's more interesting to me personally than the dopamine spike that comes from it and all the benefits you read about, whatever. Sure, it feels good. It wakes me up. Sometimes I seek it for that, but sometimes I just love looking at what happens when I say I want to get in that cold plunge and what comes up in me, what kind of resistance. I find that some of the most educational content, and I can almost watch it in real time, fall out of the habit. The effort of doing it becomes higher, temperature aside, whether it's 50 degrees or 40 degrees. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another kind of mindful practice or self-awareness curiosity I'd encourage people to look at. Maybe I just overlook at these things cause it's part of my profession, but I find it fascinating.
I think it's more than fascinating. I think it's really, really beneficial. Like there's so much that can be learned if you bring presence and awareness to your resistance.
Yeah.
So much can be investigated around that in real time, or you can, process old patterns, old experiences, old traumas, whatever it is that led to your particular brand of resistance to something that part of your mind is saying you want to bring into your life or cultivate or overcome or achieve. I've had a similar experience recently where I was with some friends and we were about to jump into a very cold lake. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there on the edge of the rock just thinking, I don't want to do this, but I do want to do this, but I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And why don't I want to, I don't want to feel uncomfortable. I don't want to feel the shock of the cold. But I do want to be in communitas with these people too. There's a social aspect, no peer pressure. People are like, whatever, whatever peer pressure was there, I invented in my own mind. And so just getting curious about that resistance and then having enough experience with this, knowing that when you push past the resistance, there is an incredible reward on the other side. It could just be satisfaction that you did a hard thing. In the case of the cold water, it could be this, this nice dopamine afterglow that you're going to experience.
Yeah.
And so I jump in and this was a very cold lake and it hurt. Instantly my breath is taken away. I'm trying to remember my breathing, sitting in there, and then I get out and I can barely feel my limbs and it took me an hour to warm up. But afterward I was like, okay, remember how you get scared of stuff and that sometimes you, if you're mindfully aware of that fear, it's not necessarily a signal to you saying that don't do this. It's a signal to you saying I'm unwilling. And yeah. What happens when you turn up that dial of willingness? There's a lot to be gained on the other side.
Yeah, I love that. And I think I even mentioned to you recently, I don't know if it's a serious comment or not, maybe I'll do it, but I should tattoo on myself, seek discomfort. Yeah. It's just a good reminder. I do think there's value in flexing the muscle with love and self-compassion, of course, and all within reason of moving towards, orienting yourself towards the hard things, the things you resist, the uncomfortable things, and balance that with the easy or rewarding or pleasurable ones.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the balance, because I started by sort of tongue-in-cheek accusing the certain internet communities or influencers of really just telling one side of the story, that you need to grind, you need to push hard, you know, you need to overcome, you need to optimize. We also need to rest.
Yeah.
And rest isn't just sort of indulgent self-care. It you know, hell, if you want to optimize, you need to rest too. So rest comes from self-compassion, like you mentioned. But it is not necessarily a moral good. This is now me just sort of speaking my opinion. as if I'm never not, but it's not a moral good just to grind yourself into dust, because for what? To make a bunch of money, to impress others, even in service of others. Like if you're dust, you can't continue to be in service of others. So yes, we want to embrace discomfort. We want to seek discomfort. And I would say in equal measures, we want to seek peace. We want to seek rest. We want to seek recuperation, rejuvenation.
Yeah. You have to factor all that in. I think about, on the example I gave of going to a yoga class, it becomes different every time I try to reinsert, and try is a fun word, because try to reinsert a 6 a.m. yoga habit that I know it does beautiful things for how I feel throughout the day and how I feel like I'm thriving in life. And sometimes it falls off. And then getting back on that horse is really a fascinating battle. And you have to balance in all the things like taking care of yourself, being gentle, prioritizing sleep and all those things and all these choices and things we have to balance. But it does represent this really interesting, like you said, drag yourself to it phenomenon, or almost an inner battle. And I think that's an example of these pathways at play, or that tension at play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll just underscore, foot stomp the non-shaming self-compassion aspect that you brought up as you're doing this, even if you're in the throes of addiction, let's say, and you're really, really frustrated with yourself. Maybe even the behavior that you're captured by is damaging social relationships, damaging the people you love the most. You know, hating yourself into health is almost never going to be the case. So a nice helping of self-compassion, self-love, and then using that as a scaffold to do the hard things. Mm-hmm. Because resensitizing one's dopamine system is going to be really, really difficult, like we said. And so to open yourself up to and embrace that difficulty and discomfort is the obstacle that is the way.
You mentioned having people there when facing something uncomfortable can be helpful, not in a peer pressure way. And, you know, what you're talking about makes me think of how important it is to have empathy and understanding for other people's inner battles on this front, just like we need to apply to ourselves. I heard this interesting analogy in the field of addiction recovery of like when you're in the throes of addiction, it could feel like you're in quicksand. And then this interesting spin-off of this, someone said, imagine that you're sinking and the only person there at the side of this quicksand you're in is someone who recently threatened to kill you and is unsafe, and they hold out a thorny branch covered in cow dung. How many humans would reach for that branch rather than die? Almost all of them. But if you were just standing there and the person who wanted to kill you brought it out to you, would you reach for it? No. And the decision, choice analysis of choice, that we're talking about, the effort computation, can get so skewed where that kind of example just helps remind me of how much understanding we all need to extend to people in the throes of an out of control pattern. Not that there aren't terrible consequences, and of course we need to do everything we can to protect ourselves and others from those really negative consequences. But it's not something you can just think your way out of so easily.
Right. Agreed. Other things, Reed, other things people can do to maybe reset or that they ought to know about dopamine.
Well, one fun corollary to take to venture far away from the neuroscience textbooks would be like looking at how has this been communicated through Eastern religious philosophy over the past several thousand years. Because like, if you look at Buddhism, for example, a lot of our modern psychology draws a lot of wisdom from it.
Yeah.
There's this process comes long before we had cell phones and computers and these, the society we're talking about that's ripe for habit forming behavior. There was this process called dependent origination of like, this concept that when a cue goes into our mind interprets it as pleasant, unpleasant, and we have an urge to make the unpleasant things go away and make the pleasant things stay. And they would even call this, this is just a translation, the birth of self-identity. Hmm. Or like we talk about ego death on here, that's kind of ego birth in a way. Hmm. Or you're talking about flexing an ego, that's the kind of thing you can strengthen, a pattern of going towards unpleasant things, seeking discomfort, or just going or reinforcing hedonic pleasure pathways. And then we start to get identified with these actions, like this adage, we are what we repeatedly do. And then it gets reinforced and perpetuated even more. And it all happens, not all of it, but for some people, most of it, under the surface of our awareness, in this, you know, I guess what you might call subjective bias that someone has. And this is one of the big roots of suffering from some of these Eastern views of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And in an interesting way, much of what we would call our personality is simply patterns, habits of thought, habits of being, habits of reacting, reinforced or not reinforced. So the wisdom from Eastern traditions would say what to help navigate such waters?
Awareness.
Yeah,
awareness, right, is the greatest change agent. But say we apply it
and non-attachment, right?
Yeah, yeah. And those things, as humans in human form, we are motivated by our desires, wants, needs, and we also react to harm, and we're wired in such a way that this all happens through our neurotransmitter soup and other machinery. I think to answer that question, if we were to look at like the addicted brain as an example, you have addiction arising out of repeating patterns, or there's an automaticity to it, an automatic habit where the behavior that's reinforced tends to recur. Light a cigarette, do it often enough, and you will just start to do it without having to tell yourself to get the lighter out of your pocket. You could say consciously, mentally, I want to change, but your body's still going to do that, right, like an hour later, because it's outside of your awareness and it's in this automaticity department. And as you become more and more addicted, you can get hypersensitive to pain, anhedonic, things that we've been talking about, this combination of factors that can be pretty miserable, like the automatic habit and hypersensitive to pain and dysregulated emotion, and negative mood states. And then you insert this light of awareness into the equation, and like you've talked about here that you do with your clients, is inserting that pause and something else between the stimulus and response.
Right. Yeah, we've talked a lot about that. We've had a couple episodes on habit changing and formation, but when you were talking, it made me think of the power of some psychedelics to treat some addictions. and that what is it that psychedelics are doing? One of the things, I mean, they're doing a lot of things neurochemically, but one of the things they're doing is bringing that light of awareness in sort of a degree of intensity
that
is more than just cortical, right? It's more than just sort of conscious. It's a lived, embodied knowing, like, oh, I don't need that cigarette anymore. And we've heard case reports of people who've gone down and done ayahuasca ceremonies or Ibogaine or even after psilocybin or LSD, and they just never pick up a cigarette again. And these are longtime smokers.
Yeah. So we've got to become aware of something before we can change it. You know, what's interesting as an aside, I'm thinking about that Peloton example of where I've wanted to get on it and introduce it as a habit. The yoga habit doesn't fall off and is easy to start, but why that one? Interesting exception was after I've come back from ayahuasca ceremony. Mm-hmm. And this is just an N of one, with all the disclaimers around subjective bias and all that. But I find myself able to, for days after that, just get up and do the thing I want to do. Mm-hmm. I know we talk about it as a pattern reset, a neuroplasticity window, a blank slate of sorts. I have, at least personally, anecdotally experienced it that way as well.
Yeah, me too. And I think one of the special things about ayahuasca ceremonies, as they are conducted, is the preparatory phase, right?
You're primed for it.
Where you are, if you're following what's called the dieta or the diet, both what you ingest and what you take in terms of media, people you surround yourself with, it's a way of purposely bringing awareness to your patterns. Like, why do I need that thing? Why do I feel like I need that thing? Do I really need it, or is it just a habit? And if you do that thoroughly enough, it sets quite a nice stage for what ayahuasca will do. But like you, I've felt just so at peace in my nervous system, in my body, in the presence of what would have been tempting stimuli in sort of the weeks and months following an ayahuasca ceremony.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that's a large part of the equation, or half the battle in this really pretty cool recipe, age-old recipe sprung from, you know, indigenous cultures of how to gain insight and change in positive ways. But I forget what I was going to say. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, you know, it's also why we relentlessly talk about the importance of preparation when we talk about psychedelic assisted therapy, not only to have a workable intention in mind, but to, like I said, with ayahuasca, just sort of set the cerebral stage for the work that the medicine is going to do in there. The more thoroughly and more thoughtfully and mindfully you prep, in most cases, the more you're going to get out of a psychedelic therapy experience.
Yeah, it's so true. And to bring back the Buddhist wisdom into this discussion is in the Dhammapada, one of the classic Buddhist texts. It talks about, like, just as a tree cut down can grow again and again if the roots are undamaged and strong, in the same way, if the roots of craving are not uprooted wholly, the sorrows will come again and again. It's kind of a rough half translation of it, but it makes sense. Like, it's craving at its core, which is one of the kind of wellsprings of our suffering. Mm-hmm. Desire may create the universe, but it can also destroy it.
Right. Yeah. Right. This is a bit of a non sequitur, but you mentioning Buddhism made me think of the Sabbath day in sort of Abrahamic religions, and it being sort of a culturally created or maybe divinely inspired dopamine reset. like let's rest from work. Don't take these many steps, like all these prescriptions, right? Depending on the religious text you look at. But I think for as long as human beings have grappled with desire, with craving, with attachments, we've also come up with quote unquote technologies or rituals or wisdoms to help us rebalance what can get out of balance.
Yeah, those can be a key part of habit formation. Yeah. And the presence of a supportive other, like you mentioned in cold plunging,
right.
There's, I've said this probably ad nauseum in different times on here, is like the presence of the supportive other is one of the most helpful things to surf, ride the wave of that craving towards an unhealthy maladaptive behavior and get to the other side without acting on it.
Like, yeah.
Just having someone seeing you as a handhold, as a support, and not, it's for so many reasons. Yeah.
Part of the wisdom of like 12-step programs and the idea of a sponsor, right? Somebody, a supportive other who's always on call.
Yeah.
Somebody you can reach out to when you're really having a hard time surfing that urge wave.
So just like we're catching up with modern science to what the Buddhists understood about our reward circuitry, I think to answer that question more practically of what to do about it, you know, we're also catching up with the, you know, the scientific understanding of how helpful what we call mindfulness or mindfulness-based practices can be in breaking these patterns. And I would say it needs to be awareness, or like non-judgmental mindful awareness of, you know, how our minds work. Mm-hmm. We got to figure out what the rewards are and why we're doing the things we do so we can start to change them to a certain degree. And then like, so we can see the trigger, the behavior, the loops. And then we use that practice state of mindfulness to insert that pause, turn towards the discomfort of being in a place where you're not immediately seeking the reward. And maybe at a different baseline elevation of dopamine that you're standing and feeling from, and then deciding, because you've been practicing that in these ways, like we're talking about, practicing mindfulness, practicing in therapy, practicing turning towards discomfort in life.
Right. Yeah. Well said. Your comments about awareness made me think of one of the solutions or strategies that Lemke talks about in her book, is radical honesty, which is basically another term for what you're talking about with awareness.
Yeah.
Like, let's really look at what I'm trying to create, what I want to extinguish, and why. Why do I keep doing this? Again, not shaming, with all the compassion in the world, to connect some kind of meaning for you to what's going to be this fairly difficult endeavor of urge surfing and seeking discomfort and reaching out to others, asking for support.
Yeah. Yeah. No, sounds, I agree completely. I think we've covered a lot of dopamine ground.
Sure have. Last thing I'll say is start small. If you're listening to this and you're like, oh man, I don't know if I can do the 6 a.m. yoga class, or I don't know if I can jump in the cold pond, or if I can quit smoking, it's okay to just start small and start small with cultivating some awareness and a little bit of tolerance to discomfort. And that could simply be, I'm noticing I've been on TikTok for an hour. I'm going to put my phone down. I'm going to stare at the wall for 5 seconds and just be me for 5 seconds. Maybe I'll set a reminder on my phone to do that, to stand up and look out the window for a few seconds and then gradually build.
Yeah, I like it. And maybe to boil down some of the excessive scientific commentary and, you know, something a little more simple, I'd say that dopamine really isn't about your dopamine level. What we're talking about is everything to do with your, like, your dopamine receptors and your circuitry, because like we're talking about, as you activate things over time, if you're dumping dopamine into a system, your receptors receiving are going to say, whoa. It happens with our neurons' habituation. Mm. It's called, you put on a t-shirt, your skin receptors feel it for a time, and then thankfully they stop feeling it, because that would drive us crazy.
Right.
Or you walk into a room with a smell, you were wired to detect threat. Seek pleasure. You're going to detect it for a time, and then our neurons will be like, okay, I've sent my signal. I'm going to go chill now. So I bring that up because it's like the answers to this puzzle aren't about seeking those dopamine spikes, right? It's about just being aware of and conscious and intentional about what wolf we feed and what pathways we strengthen, and being patient with the process, because because we're not talking about these little minute-to-minute spikes, we're talking about our receptors and our circuitry that develop over days, if not weeks, in habit formation.
It takes time.
Yeah.
Return to balance. Well, thanks, Reed.
Yeah, fun as always, Steve. Talk to you next time.
All right. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.